All rights reserved, Steve Coleman and the Origami VanCast. The Origami VanCast is an audio podcast resource for the chronic pain patient and is for those who suffer from ill-defined, sometimes referred to as throwaway, diagnoses. Basically, if the cause of your disease is not well understood by current medicine, let me tell you about a couple of fundamental systems within your body that your doctor wasn't educated about in med school. These systems are the endocannabinoid system and the fascial systems, and both are the subject of current ongoing research. As a patient who has suffered due to the ignorance of both of these systems, I don't want anyone else to suffer unnecessarily. I quit my six-figure job designing lasers and moved into a van in order to finish curing myself, and now I feel obligated to try to highlight the new and important research in these fields, adding whatever value my experience might to the work of the scientists. Hello, chronic pain patients of the world. This is the Origami VanCast. I'm Steve Coleman. This week, so for the chronic pain section, I think, you know, we've gotten a little bit heavy. I've been a little hard on you guys. I thought maybe I would tell a story. I've been wanting to tell this story for a while, but trying to find a good time to fit it in, I guess. It's really a story that kind of got me in the predicament of being in the chronic pain that I was in the first place, in that it's sort of a story about how I eliminated all manner of fear, not so much intentionally, but just through circumstances, through rock climbing. So when I started college, I pretty much immediately started climbing on the university's climbing wall, and I became a climbing wall instructor, even though I had no experience climbing. You really just needed to supervise people, make sure they tied in correctly, that sort of thing. And I climbed inside. Eventually, I went on a trip, and I got a few climbing partners, and eventually went a few places outside, including Las Vegas. And I sort of became, we didn't actually complete any multi-pitch routes while I was in Las Vegas, but I became sort of fascinated with these routes that were quote-unquote multi-pitch. So this means that there's more than one rope length, or you need to stop, you know, some significant amount of a rope length up and restart again and go on, perhaps many times. Each one of those is called a pitch. So my climbing partner for many years is a man named Sean Rodabaugh, and we met in probably 1996. And we worked together. We were in the same training class, we developed a friendship. And Sean knew I was looking for a climbing partner, and he said that that he would be down for climbing with me. So I started, you know, we started taking him to the climbing wall a little bit, and then in pretty short order for spring break, we headed out to Las Vegas to go climb outside. So I don't remember the exact scenario, how we get there, but we ended up on a route that I had climbed the year before with my other climbing partners, which had since moved on, you know, and left university. And what we did when we climbed that route, so the route's called Physical Graffiti, and you can actually go onto YouTube and find a drone video on this, and I'm going to put a link to that video in the show notes. And there's a flyby in the beginning, and you'll notice, and then there's some other flybys. We watch a whole video of people tied in at some anchors. Those anchors are at the top of the first pitch. There's another pitch that goes on up above that, at least whenever I climbed it back in 97, didn't have any anchors up at the top. But if you notice the flyby in the beginning, I think it's about 1 minute in, right as it gets to the very top of the quote-unquote mountain. There's a small little cave there. And that's kind of the top of the route, at least what I did it. This is back in the days before GPS was actually, I think GPS had just become available, but it still had selective availability turned on. So the government actually dithered the signal to where you didn't know the location to within 100 meters. So that was something that they used to do. And they turned that off in that time period as GPS became commercialized. Anyway, just giving you a taste that there were no cell phones back then, or at least not that would work in that area. And Sean and I hiked to the base of Physical Graffiti and proceeded to knock it out. This would be my first multi-pitch route. I had never really climbed outside, or I never climbed multi-pitch before. I had climbed outside, but I wasn't really a lead climber very much. I had always climbed with other people on lead, but I decided it was time to learn. So because we had done the first pitch before, it was kind of just climb right up to the top of the first pitch and tie into the anchors and get everything done. Now, the guidebook that I had, this is a printed guidebook. There wasn't really internet to look at routes and that sort of thing at this time. And most people, you know, as we did the year before, rappel off of the anchors after the first pitch. But I really wanted to do a multi-pitch route. I really wanted to know what it was like to top out and then how to get down and that sort of thing. So I just had to do it. And, the crack above those anchors is off width, and it's kind of jagged and nasty. It's not a lot of fun to climb. It's kind of hard to protect. You really need some long draws, and it's hard to get stuff back in there. But when I looked at my guidebook, the way that I read it, which I believe was incorrect, was that the second pitch was half the length of the first, which I would find out pretty soon was not going to be true. But anyway, I collected the amount of gear that I needed to go above. It was a woefully inadequate amount of gear, but I was a poor college student, didn't have a lot. And also, I didn't want to carry a lot, you know, up through this this jagged off-width chimney, which this would be a potentially fatal mistake in the literal sense of the word. So, Sean and I parted ways. I left him hanging there at the anchors, you know, this being his first time clearly outside. And, had a little bit of concern for him, but I knew that, you know, if everything went bad, that he would be able to rappel down off of those anchors like we did last time. So, I began climbing, and I realized pretty quickly that I'm needing to run things out. I don't have a lot of gear. I don't have a lot of draws. And I start worrying, you know, how am I going to build anchors out of what I have left? I think I had about 3 draws left, and the top was nowhere in sight. The wind had been slowly picking up throughout the day, to the point where now, you know, it was pretty blustery and I couldn't, there was a fair bit of wind noise. But I heard Sean say something about the rope and give me a really hard tug. And so I'm sitting there, I'm probably, I think I was on about a 50-foot run out on something like, I think it was the pink one, like what is that, a number half tricam. That had just been kind of set in a wedge in the crack. I mean, it was a lousy placement. You know, this was in my early days of placing gear, and this was not an easy route to protect in this section of it, and especially not with the gear that I had. And so really, I was looking at something over a 100-foot fall on a very lousy piece. And so I heard, you know, I felt Sean pull on the rope and say something about rope, but the wind was blowing. I had to lean over sort of a bulge that stuck out to get my head out there, and I had him yell again. And I heard him say very clearly, "You're out of rope." Okay, so I was, what was it? If I had a 50-meter rope, then the first pitch is something like 25 meters up, and then the second pitch would be all, you know, close to 50, which is a few hundred feet. It's substantial. And when you look at the flyby on YouTube, you can see. So I'm sitting there thinking about, or I'm standing there, that's kind of thinned out in this area. The cracks have gone pretty thin and starting to slab out, as they say, or at least as we used to say, near the top. But I didn't know where the anchors were. I couldn't see or where I was supposed to set anything up, where I'm supposed to go. And as I'm sitting there, this time period was not all that long. The wind was really picking up. That's when it began to rain hard. Now, I'll just remind you that I'm now out of gear and out of rope, like over 300 feet off the ground, in the rain on desert sandstone. And I mentioned sandstone because if you know anything about rock, whenever sandstone gets wet, it becomes brittle. I had the year before in Arkansas, on a route that we thought was dry and many other people climbed before me, but I broke a hold off of a route and ended up falling upside down and almost hitting the ground. So the instability of sandstone when it's wet was definitely crossing my mind, but more importantly, it's also slippery because it's vertical up and down. So I'm in vertical territory with now rain pouring. This was not a small rainstorm. This was, you know, Vegas can get some really heavy rainstorms. And back in those days, this is before they put in all the big drainage and everything. So it was an ordeal. So this definitely sped up my thinking, and it definitely made my situation difficult to deal with. Now, if I had more time to think and a more experienced second down there on the anchors, I probably would have just had him simul-climb with me. But that didn't really seem like an option, and there really, and part of the reason was because of the pro between us, the protection, the gear that I had placed was so sketchy. I really didn't feel that simul-climbing on it, especially once we got up far enough to the anchors, you know, that there would even be anything left, because I just didn't have anything to protect where we were at. All right. So what I did was made the decision to very quickly yell at Sean directions how to get down by himself. And there on the side of the rock in the rain, I untied that rope from my harness, my only tether. And I untied the full knot from the end where it was just loose rope. And shaking with complete, with no, in complete disbelief that I was about to do what I was about to do. But I yelled at Sean, and I held the rope up out over the bulge, and I dropped it, and I watched it disappear from my sight in the rain. It was pretty scary. But I immediately decided, you know, it's time to start climbing. So I just started climbing. And eventually I made my way up in the rain to the very small cave that you see at the top. You know, it felt like it was just kind of big enough to stuff my body in and kind of get out of the water a little bit. But I was able to find in there some places where I would set anchors if I had any gear left and any draws left. And so while the rain was coming down and I was hoping that Sean was getting down and going to survive himself, I was thinking, well, if I have to go back and get my, you know, many hundreds of dollars of aircraft aluminum and gear that's stuck in that crack, maybe I can lower Sean down from this location. So this rainstorm actually was a major one, and the only break in it for the next 12 hours or so was the one that that we used to actually get off the mountain and get down. So whenever the sun came out a little bit and the rain pretty much stopped, I started down the descent gully, which was rushing with water. There were little, you know, 10, 15 foot waterfalls, if I remember correctly, slippery things. I kind of just flew down this, sliding and running and jumping. And I was really concerned that Sean, you know, was going to, I wanted him to get down safely. And as I got to the end, I heard a loud thunk, hit the ground as I was coming to the corner of the descent gully to where I could start to see the area where the base of the route was. And I yelled out for Sean, and he yelled back at me. He just, had pulled the rope. And so what we did was we went back up the descent gully and got some gear with us, and I lowered Sean all the way down, and he retrieved the gear. When we went back down, we definitely, you know, we decided that we were going to go back to the camp at this place. You know, that was definitely close enough to death for both of us for the day. So we camped, but like I said, it kept raining. We were in a tent on the BLM land there in a numbered campsite, I believe, right on the edge of a wash. And sometime in the middle of the night, We woke up to find that that wash was nearly overtaken with all of the water that was coming down. So we hastily packed up our camp, which was sopping wet and, you know, dirty, and headed back to Oklahoma because it just seemed like Las Vegas was trying to kill us that year. So, you know, I left out a lot of what was going through my mind whenever I did untie that, but I will tell you that, you know, just to be short about it, that that experience, you know, it had an effect on me that made me sort of impervious to fear, or at least, you know, you have to put fear aside and function in that situation, because there was no time to sit there and not function. I think overall, you know, it was a good experience for me, but not having any fear is bad. And I probably got pretty close to that point after this incident. Anyway, I know it's not a chronic pain story, but it tells you a little bit of something about me. And I think it's a pretty decent story. If you don't like it, maybe I'll take it off the episode. All right, this is episode 11, the meat section. I did it out of order here, so I'm doing the meat section last. And I wrote these notes a few days ago. I've been tapering down, and it is infrequent for me to get a dosage of THC these days, because I've been using trying to get by with just a CBG by itself. It's not working. But anyway, I'm still minimizing the THC. Anyway, I wrote this down whenever I had some THC in my system, which is helpful for getting the information out. And, so what I was doing was actively gripping at the ground with my feet. My leg again was shattered. There was a nail down the middle. I'll tell you a little bit about the leg. I don't think I've mentioned it before. It was a non-union for about 9 months, which means the bones didn't heal. It was actually bolted together a little bit, twisted and crooked. So the bones, couldn't heal, until I had some screws removed after several months. But what this manifested itself as the healing process is that I went from two crutches to one crutch to a cane to about 2 weeks with nothing to a cane to one crutch. And then I was about to go back to two crutches, or I was getting pretty close, whenever I had an appointment with the doctor. And only as I was departing did we have the realization that those screws needed to come out. And actually it was done the next day. But until those screws came out, the bones wouldn't heal together. So I'll see if I can put an x-ray of my leg after the accident, before it had the pin in it, or maybe I'll look at putting some x-rays on, Instagram. For the leg. But the bones healed back pretty crooked. And there were some big, there were two big bumps, one in the tibia, one in the fibula, where the non-unions occurred. Now they're healed together at those bumps. And during this time when I was gripping the ground and writing this down, I could feel their twisted nature. I could feel them pushing obliquely on the bones of my feet. In particular, the metatarsals, mostly on the inner arch of my foot from above. And on the medication, I was able to focus and stress on that tension, on the pressure, and it hurt. But eventually it begins to loosen, and the fascia in my foot begins to burn and tear. And then all of a sudden, after that burning and tearing, the patellar tendon on that leg, my right leg, snapped and moved a little bit to the right. The the divot, which I've mentioned in other shows, which is the area where the tissue is missing from my leg and just here directly to the bone, that area then began to spasm. Within 30 seconds of the spasming there in the divot, the tibialis anterior, which is the muscle on the front of the leg, it snapped and slid sideways just below the divot. And when I palpated in that area, I would get something like what I would previously have called nerve pain. Now, if I may put a paper in the show notes, I can't find it. I mean, I'm going to have to go download it again, so that's why I'm super vague about it here. But there's a paper that's written by, I believe, Carla Stecco's group, or at least in collaboration with her group, about the tibialis anterior, but in a mouse model, I believe it was. But basically, any immobilization of that caused it to become, if I remember correctly, caused it to become fibrotic. And my tibialis anterior was something crazy. That's what I've talked about in breaking up the leg in the other shows, and like Leg and Waffles, when I talk about going out to California, all that stuff. That was the tibialis anterior that was breaking apart. And until I actually tore that tissue loose, you could not see the big lumps in the bone, in the two bones, in the tibia and the fibula. I asked this question to my doctor. I said, hey, you know, if I've got these non-unions, you can clearly see on the x-ray there's these big lumps of bone in there. Why can't I see that through the tissue? And the answer is a shrug. I kind of still have that question, but the bottom line was that the tissue just had completely atrophied and stuck to the bone, and it wasn't doing anything. And actually, all of you look at where your tibialis anterior goes and all that, it certainly compromised the function of my ankle and my foot, the arch of my foot. So breaking it up was great and very helpful. Let me finish about that. So the breaking it up, when that happened, when I came back from California and had spent more time tearing at it and everything, it started sticking out, and you could see those bumps, and the muscle itself was very flaccid and weak, to the point where my massage therapist and other doctors and things thought that maybe it was a vascular problem and I had done something, but actually it was a tibialis anterior. And now, I hike and walk and run, and there's quite a bit of muscle there in front, and you can definitely see me flex it and move it around. And it's certainly not vascular. There may be some other stuff going on that I'd like someone that is an expert in fascia to look at, but I don't think there's anything too bad. I think it's all healed. It's just kind of mangled. So anyways, that's, the tibialis anterior moved in this particular incident. It's not uncommon. And it's been kind of what's going on as my foot changes shape. But I continued, once it moved in this incident that I'm describing here, I continued to reseat and then strongly grip at the ground with my foot. So really use it like I was grabbing at it with my foot. Whenever I say I reseat my foot, so once the muscles moved and I reseated, this is like I've talked earlier about the code in my metatarsals and tarsals. I had to move the foot around, kind of work that code out, and then re-grip the ground again. This causes the bones to pop. And now, as my foot's reseated and I'm gripping the ground again, I'm then able to stress the tibia and the fibula apart. And again, that hurts. And then the outer part of the arch, not so medial as what happened with the event when the TA moved, when the tibialis anterior moved, but now, more towards the center and the outer edge of the foot, the arch in there, it started to tear. So there's sort of like two types of things that I feel, and they tend to alternate whenever you get into this mode. You can feel that the bones are out of whack, and this is when you need to reseat your foot. So then I work out the code, and then I grab at the ground, move the bones around, and then grab down at the ground. So That is the rigid part of reorienting the bones. And then once you do that, now the bones are in an orientation that's going to allow you to apply some tension into the soft tissues. And then when you do that in the soft tissues, you can tear those loose. And then again, once those tear loose, as I've already given examples here, then the bones can move again, and it sort of alternates back and forth. Move a bone, tear some tissue, move some bones, tear some tissue. And this goes for as long as you've got the medication on board and it's effective and you're able to maintain the exercises. So all of this is doing the balancing of the eight balls that I talk about over again. You just feel the tension in the bones through the eight balls and then maintain it kind of as I have described. It is painful to tear the tissue sometimes, and it can be a little bit scary. And I would just encourage you to develop a relationship with the pain and with your unconscious mind on what it all means. And it will guide you. The pain will be your guide. It's something that you can lean into a little bit, and if it gets really bad, you stop and change. And so if as you start to exercise more and everything, if you're like me and you notice that your joints are unstable, you just need to make sure that you keep very good form in any kind of exercises that you do, and to keep your motions varied. And something that I haven't really spoken about, but I really think it is something that I am certainly going to deal with for the rest of my life, is to be very careful in engaging with any kind of machine. And this particularly includes bicycles. You know, I've ridden bicycles since I was a very small child, pretty seriously. And while I don't necessarily blame them for my problems, I do think that the axles of the pedals and the fact that, you know, our exquisitely adaptable bodies are being made to interface with what is really a crude machine and what really has crude sort of pivots and crude joints to it, just to, you know, these cylindrical axes of rotation. I think it's important to keep your motions much more varied than what you get on using any kind of machine for any amount of time. And it's just been my experience here in my recovery that whenever I do engage with a machine, or I do something like put the armrest down on the seat in my van, that whatever motion it locks out or prevents by the axle of rotation that's there seems to really cause me trouble. My body does not seem to like that, so I spend my time finding reasons to move around. I'm at Canyonlands. I'm in the Needles District. I've got a nice little campsite here. So in the weed section today, what I want to talk about, I guess, is addiction and knowing addiction and breaking addiction. I got to say the Steve Coleman way. I don't have any education in this other than what I learned in my own experience. And I don't know. Since I've done it, I feel like I know something about it that I can tell you about. I'm not a big drug user, I guess you'd say, but I have been on pain medicines for a large part of my life, and have had to break addiction to those several times. And I'm currently breaking addiction to marijuana. So, you know, knowing and breaking addiction is about being honest with yourself. It's about, you know, what is addiction? Well, if you're using something on a routine, you're probably addicted. Try and get off the routine. If you can't get off your routine without significant effort or for longer than a day or two, you're addicted. Maybe you're fine with being addicted, and maybe the addiction serves you at this point in time. much as my addiction to marijuana is serving my body right now. But if you want to break addiction, and that means breaking the routine, then the first thing that you've got to do is disrupt that routine, and you've got to do it thoroughly, because we know how bad these drugs want us to take them. So you need to remove the possibility of you having access to the drug if possible. To do it in my way. You need to have strength in bits, and even if you give up, don't give up. You have to have the expectation that this is going to need to happen over and over and over again. People that quit cigarettes, how many times have they tried? But you have to, even if you start again, you have to quit again. You have to keep trying, and you try and make it a little bit longer. Try and just make a little bit gain. Like, the next time you quit, just go one day longer, go 1 hour longer, go 1 minute longer, something. Do something to make some progress. I say here, be public AF. You are quitting. So I try and tell a lot of people when I'm doing something or modifying my doses or whatever, try and tell them what I'm doing. And it kind of just helps me to be accountable to them, even if they never ask again. I know that people remember what I say. And so when you say that you're going to quit and then a year later you haven't, people are like, why haven't you? So that's a good kind of pressure to have on yourself if you really want to quit, and you should. Before you even try and quit, you've got to identify what activity you're going to fill whatever time with this, whatever your addiction is doing for you. Maybe you spend so much time stoned that, you've got hours that are going to be available to you, and you need to find a hobby or something, and that's great. And you should. And maybe your first hobby should be exercise, if you don't already exercise. Let's talk about that. Meditation, exercise, study, foreign language, mathematics, whatever. What you need here, a replacement. You don't need a crutch, and you don't want a replacement addiction. You don't want to replace your opiate with methadone. You don't want to replace your opiate with nicotine. You don't want to replace a drug with another drug. Replacing an addiction with an addiction is not going to help you. You need to adjust your strategy continuously on how you're going to handle it and how you're going to handle yourself. And are you responding? Are you staying off of the drug, or are you trying to get back on, or do you feel it trying to pull you in, or do you know that the next time that you see it, you're going to use it? If that's the case, then you've got to stay away from it and not see it. It's about being honest with yourself. It's about being accountable to yourself. It's about having enough respect for yourself to know that you can do this. You are worthy of not being addicted to drugs and being controlled. You're worthy. It seems hard. Man, how am I going to wake up in the morning without my cup of coffee? Just do it. Once you start doing it a few times, it becomes much easier. It's just the first few times that are a problem. And I can tell you, as far as breaking addictions go, fentanyl is really super strong, but it's not the hardest addiction that I've ever broken. The hardest that I've broken has actually been Valium, because it goes on for such a long time. The withdrawals are just on and on and on for months, that you feel it, that you need this. And a lot of that is where I'm at right now, with... didn't exactly plan on being this open with you, but where I'm at right now, as I'm trying to get off of marijuana, I'm trying to replace the marijuana with exercise and to generate my own cannabinoids, so that I don't have to go buy phytocannabinoids from a predatory industry here in America, like all the other predatory industries that deal with our health. And the THC, it has a double effect. And maybe the CBN as well, but it certainly helps with the, the tearing and everything. It enables it. But it also helps with the depression that you get during withdrawal. just obviously, I mean, this is sort of what, I mean, everyone knows that THC does, right? And it makes you, supposedly makes you depressed and takes away your, what is it, your dopamine, maybe. I'll have to look that up. But it's helpful, and it's been helpful, actually, to help me, like, what I wrote here, I actually wrote while I was high. I'm not high right now. But the stuff that I have down on the paper is largely because I was high, and that, helped the thoughts come out of my mind and onto the paper. But some of it, you know, I may continue to need this medication, and this is where, you know, I have, trouble. But, even if you do end up needing it to help your condition, I think, you know, making sure that you have control over whatever drugs you're on. And I felt this way back, you know, whenever I had broken bones and after surgeries and that sorts of thing as well. It's whenever you feel that you need to compulsively take anything, that you're in trouble. You need to be aware. You need to be able to control your activities. And if you're going to dabble in healing yourself using weed or any other drug, then I think it's a good exercise to definitely keep a handle on it and be aware. So here at my camp here in Mancos, I dug out an very old X-ray from the day of my accident that was taken once I landed in Oklahoma City, and you can see it's pretty messed up. I don't know a lot about legs, but that's not the way they're supposed to look. And I think it's pretty presumptuous to show up at a doctor's place of employment and ask him to put one of those back together right then, which I did. So I want to, you know, reach out to that doctor specifically. His name is Dr. Thomas P. Jansen of the McBride Orthopedic Clinic. He still practices there. Even 20 years later. And so a lot of times when I'm talking about doctors, I know I come across as maybe, you know, being harsh on them or something, but I have all the respect in the world for them, and very much appreciate the ones that that have put me back together. The fact that I have the function that I do, you know, is his doing, and I can't I can't say anything other than you know, in olden times, had I done something that egregious to myself, they probably would have just cut it off, and maybe even today, depending on what location where you end up and what tools they have on hand at that time. So thank you, Dr. Jansen, and Dr. Jansen still takes care of members of my family today. I hope that both doctors and patients understand that we all have our roles to play here, and I think there's a lot more that can be done on the patient's side if we understand properly how our bodies work and how to interpret pain and what how to act upon it. But I wanted to finish up and say that it is my plan to put out in season zero a total of 12 episodes. So there'll be one more after this. And then the show will change format probably. I am going to put out my PayPal address. And if you would like to support the show, I would, of course, appreciate that. Finally, you know, thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And I hope that we can continue a conversation and make some positive steps forward in your life and toward treating your chronic illness. Thanks for listening to the Origami Vancast. We'll see you next time.